You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
American offices may have moved beyond Mad Men-era gender roles, and secretarial pools may be a thing of the past now that women make up the majority of the workforce, but that doesn't mean women no longer face daily obstacles at their jobs. In her latest book, Joan C. Williams, distinguished professor and director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California's Hastings College of Law, draws on hundreds of published studies and her interviews with more than 125 successful working women to learn why office politics remain harder for women, and she suggests ways of dealing with it. She has co-written this book, What Works for Women at Work, Four Patterns Working Women Need to Know, with her daughter Rachel Dempsey, who is a writer and a student at Yale Law School. The book is published by NYU Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Joan C. Williams back to our show. Hello.
Delighted to be here.
Now, how did you begin researching this book? Call all the most successful women you knew of?
Well, it really began 15 years ago when I began reading these experimental social psychology studies that typically you give people identical resumes in a lab and you ask, you know, one's Jane, one's John, who would you hire? And when I started reading those studies, it was the force of a revelation because I thought, oh, my God, this is my life. So then I decided, well—
But let me back up for a second. Were the people who had given the resumes all male?
It varied, but often gender bias against women is held by women as well as men. So I wondered if these experimental studies done in college labs actually describe what's going on in today's workplace. And that's why for about a three-year period, every time I met a really savvy, successful woman, I said, can I snag an hour and a quarter of your time? And I described what these studies showed and asked, any of that sound familiar? Every syllable, said one woman. Another woman said just what I'd said. You just described my life.
Why did you focus on women in the 30s and older? Why not younger women?
I wanted to get women who were truly successful at the top of their fields, although not all superstars, since what happens to superstars is often quite different from what happens to women who are just one notch below. And that's most of us.
Well, but your daughter is your co-author. She's 27, obviously a member of the younger demographic.
Now, there's a superstar. I wanted to write this with a woman who was in her 20s, because often when older women talk to younger women giving advice, there are what Rachel calls generational issues. They're really divided by their takes on gender. Women who were my age, we felt very comfortable around men and masculinity. Otherwise, we would have been housewives. In Rachel's generation, a much broader range of women seeks these jobs, often much more conventionally feminine than many women in my generation.
You think that's partly because today women outnumber men in college? And also, young single urban women often out-earn their male peers.
Yeah, I once wrote an article called "Want Equality? Died Childless at 30." Young women are graduating from college in larger numbers, but what this book shows is that once they enter the workplace, they meet four different kinds of gender bias that are still alive and well.
And what are them? What are they? What's the most common one?
The most common is what we call the tightrope. And when you think about these high-level jobs, they're typically seen as requiring masculine qualities, but women are expected to be feminine. So women walk a tightrope between being seen as masculine in order to be competent, but disliked, or being seen as too feminine to be competent, so liked but really not respected.
And if they're aggressive, then they're seen
God
as pushy.
Them. God help them.
But if a man is aggressive, well, he's just somebody who wants to get
ahead.
He's
a go-getter.
Mm-hmm. So that's the worst of them. What are some of the others?
Three-quarters of the women reported that kind of bias. The next most common was what I call prove it again. And that's that women, if you think about, you know, most people think about a CEO, they think about a man. So women don't seem to fit quite as well. And so for all of these high-level jobs, women often have to provide more evidence of competence in order to be seen as equally competent as a man.
And you write that as of 2011, a little over 3.5% of Fortune 500 CEOs were women. I'm assuming that that's held steady for the next 3 years. But how high up in management do they tend to go before they hit that ceiling?
Well, I mean, the most dramatic figure is that it would take over 250 years at the current rate of change to get equal numbers of male and female CEOs in the Fortune 500. Women are doing great at the entry levels, and then the higher up they go, the fewer and fewer and fewer you find.
Is that just true in this country? I mean, I've often thought about the fact that in India, in Sri Lanka, in Bangladesh, and in Liberia, and Scandinavian countries, England, the leader has often been a woman. But in the United States, where we think of women as being most liberated in the world, we have never had a woman as president.
Well, particularly in countries that still have a strong class structure, often you have, if you think about the women who have been leaders in those countries, typically they have been related to a very high-class man or from a very high-class family.
Well, they've usually been the daughter of somebody who'd been the president.
Exactly. Scandinavia actually is a great place for mothers, but has a higher level of sex segregation than the United States.
So women reach how high up before they're stopped?
It really varies. They certainly are stopped long before the very, very top.
One of the reasons you suggest women experience bias is that they usually judge on their achievements while men are judged on their potential.
That's one of the prove it again patterns. So, for example, one of the women I talked to, these very savvy women, she said that that she had the network. She had a very broad network, but she wasn't, her salary didn't reflect the breadth of her network unless she actually had work from the people in the network. Whereas a man could go out for golfing and no problem. He was seen as a major rainmaker.
In the case of women, it's better to have a mentor, somebody who will help you move up the ladder.
Well, actually, it's better to have a sponsor, a powerful man who is willing to spend his political chips for you. That hardly seems the silver bullet.
So is there something that women can do in order to be judged on the same criteria as their male coworkers?
Well, certainly if you're a woman sitting in a room and you see men being judged on their potential, women and their achievements, or double standards being applied in any way, one thing you can say is, you know, I think we finally realized what we're really looking for this position. So let's go back to the top of the pile and make sure we've got all of the candidates who have it.
My guest is Joan C. Williams, who with her daughter Rachel Dempsey has written What Works for Women at Work, Four Patterns Working Women Need to Know. You suggest that women are often viewed as hard workers and team players. Aren't those considered positive attributes? How do they actually stand in the way of a woman's success?
Well, for example, at the Center for Work-Life Law, we run a Leadership for Women law firm partners. And very often when a man gets to be a partner in a law firm, the process of him inheriting clients from his male partners is very natural and organic. But very often women law firm partners are seen as being perfect service partners, it's called. And being a service partner is not what's valued. Being a rainmaker is what's valued in a law firm. And so a lot of what we actually teach women in our leadership academy is how to get out of that service partner or dutiful daughter role. That's being a good team player, but it's not a good long-term career strategy.
In The Good Wife, the television show, the fact that Alicia is the wife of the governor has helped her career.
That's the Indira Gandhi syndrome. You know, when it works, it's sweet, but it's hardly an overall strategy for most women.
Well, if women are seen as hard workers and team players, does that mean that they're less likely to be viewed as strong leaders?
Well, it's interesting. There are the studies that show what types of leadership are accepted in women. We often hear that women have a different style of leadership, and what my study shows, and the studies that back it up, is the reason that women adopt a sort of communal, socially empathetic style of leadership is that that's the only style of leadership that is accepted in women. If women try to adopt a sort of command and control style, all of a sudden their names all begin with B.
When a woman is put in a position of leadership, Does it matter whether the people who are working for her are male, female, or a mixed group?
It matters, but not as much as you might think. There are some forms of gender bias that are actually more common among women than among men. That's not true of all of them, but it is often true. And one of the four patterns I call tug of war, and that's when gender bias against women turns into conflicts among women.
More than half of the people you interviewed were women of color. What did you learn specifically about the experiences of gender bias for them?
Well, that's part of this the study that I found most fascinating. When you think about it, there's an important conversation in this country going on around race, and there's another one going on around gender. My agenda really is to make sure the conversation going on around gender is a conversation about gender, not a conversation about white women. So I very much oversampled women of color, and the women of color, I asked three questions. I said, any of that sound familiar? One woman just burst into tears, actually. Another woman, and most women had experienced, actually 100% of the women of color I talked to had experienced one or more of the patterns of gender bias. But the their experience often differed from that of white women in sometimes obvious, sometimes subtle ways.
Well, did they attribute the discrimination that they'd experienced to their race or to their sex?
Excellent question. There's four patterns of gender bias. In only one of them, the prove it again pattern, black women tended to attribute their prove it again problems to race. The other three groups attributed their problems to gender, and that was one of the four patterns.
Didn't the women of color you interviewed feel that they had even less room for error in their jobs than their white counterparts?
A fascinating thing. They even these very highly accomplished women, very high up in their organizations, the black women felt they didn't have any room for error. They couldn't make one mistake. I should say that wasn't necessarily true of the other groups of women. For example, 60 of the women I talked to were women of color in science. And the Asian Americans felt that they often took pains to be seen as Asian rather than as a woman, because to be seen as Asian helped them, whereas to be seen as a woman hurt them.
So many of these things are just based on preconceived notions of how people are and how smart they are.
Yes, I mean, it's all being driven by unconscious stereotypes.
You report that women of color are more likely to be sexually harassed than white women.
They are, and often in very deeply offensive ways.
And that's simply because they're against stereotypes?
Well, if you think about the sort of default old-fashioned stereotypes of, for example, Asian women, sort of the lotus blossom oriental seductress. If you think about images of black women that we inherit from all the way back to slavery, they're very sexualized, often some of the stereotypes of women of color, even more so than the stereotypes of white women.
My guest, Joan C. Williams, is Distinguished Professor and Director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of Law. She's written a number of books, and her latest is co-written with Rachel Dempsey, who is a blogger at Huffington Post on women's issues and a student at Yale Law School. Their book is called What Works for Women at Work? Four Patterns Working Women Need to Know. It's published by NYU Press, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Joan C. Williams, who has co-authored with Rachel Dempsey What Works for Women at Work, Four Patterns Working Women Need to Know. It's published by New York University Press. If women notice that they're experiencing bias, how can they confront it in a way that's not openly accusing their colleagues of sexism?
That's what the entire book is about. What I did is gathered from these very successful women the strategies that they've used, and the focus is on low-risk strategies, because that's what most people, frankly, are going to use.
Because if you say you're being a sexist here, Even the most sexist person will say, I am not. Some of my best friends are women.
Not a career-enhancing move, by and large. So, for example, going back to prove it again bias, if you feel you know that your mistakes are going to be remembered and noticed more than your success is often attributed to luck, not skill. So it's very important to do two things. One is to keep careful real-time records so you can of every objective metric you have met. And the other is to establish what we call a posse, which is a group of men as well as women to celebrate each other's successes. The posse also addresses tightrope bias, because what's more appropriate in a woman than modestly celebrating somebody else's success? On the other hand, this is what I call gender judo. You're using that feminine stereotype to propel you forward. You're celebrating his success, but he's celebrating yours.
Well, you mentioned luck as a factor. In the 1930s, most of the movies had women sleeping their way up to a better position.
Yeah, there's actually a pattern that social psychologists called he's skilled, she's lucky. Another example is in the maternal wall. You would be astonished to hear how often women are told things like, this is mothers now, are told things like, well, I don't understand how you can work such long hours. My wife could never leave her kids like that. And there we recommend what I call the Tolstoy was wrong strategy. You just smile sweetly and say, you know, happy families aren't all alike.
But also, there are some families where men take on some of those responsibilities.
Actually, I wrote in my HuffPo blog a blog called The New Sexy, Millennial Men. There are some.
Now, a listener, Dan from Brooklyn, is wondering if you can make a distinction between the way black women treat the black men that work for them versus how all men treat the black women that work for them.
You know, I don't have data on that, and I'm very data-driven. I suspect there are differences, but I wouldn't want to speculate.
You mentioned 2008 Saturday Night Live skit where Tina Fey and Amy Poehler played Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton and addressed gender bias in political campaigns. How do you think this skit highlights a type of gender bias that women experience in the workplace?
Well, remember the tightrope. The tightrope women have to navigate between being seen as too feminine and therefore liked but not respected, or too masculine and therefore respected but not liked. And in that skit, Tina Fey played the Hillary Clinton, very much respected but not liked.
She played Sarah Palin, Tina Fey.
Tina Fey. Well, then I've got it backwards. Thank you for correcting me. But Sarah Palin has very much been the liked but not respected sort of two feminine dits. And Hillary Clinton has had witch problems her entire life, the highest polling numbers for a long time that Hillary had ever had were when she cried.
And she has been criticized for hairstyles, for clothing, in ways nobody would ever say John Boehner's tie was really grotesque.
No, but what Hillary Clinton did when she cried was that was an example, again, of gender judo. Everybody knows that Hillary Clinton is super competent, but she was taking that feminine stereotype of the vulnerable woman and flipping it to propel her forward, in that case, unconsciously,
On the other hand, when Edmund Muskie had his eyes teared up, he supposedly, that was the end of his campaign.
This is one of those narrow contexts in which women have more room than men. They do exist.
There's a common belief that women don't get ahead because they don't ask for raises and don't negotiate as aggressively as men. Why do you suggest that training women to negotiate their salaries and ask for promotions isn't the solution?
Well, I once wrote, women don't negotiate because they're not idiots. The popular discourse often fails to mention is that although it's true women don't negotiate as much, when women do renegotiate for higher salaries, they're less likely to be hired and people are less likely to want to work with them. So simply teaching women to ask is not the answer. Because what you have to do is to ask in a way that navigates that tightrope. And we provide very specific ways in which to do so. In which to negotiate a higher salary. For example, The next time, if it's for the women listening, the next time a recruiter calls you, she's your new best friend, even if you do not want to leave, because she can provide you objective information as to how much you're worth. And that's what you need, because you need to negotiate in a way that involves this gender judo, that you need to negotiate pointing to objective metrics with warmth and doing this masculine thing, negotiating, but in a, quote, suitably feminine way, unquote.
Well, men also use a job offer as a way of getting a raise at the job they're staying at. Do women struggle more with self-advocacy than men?
Well, struggle more. They do struggle more, but I'm not sure it's all internal. They are at risk of pushback and being seen as unlikable if they engage in self-advocacy. On the other hand, not engaging in self-advocacy is not the solution.
Well, how can women find out if they're being paid less than a male colleague with a similar job? This was actually an issue in a notable Supreme Court case where she didn't even find out that there was a big difference until the Supreme Court said the statute of limitations had run out.
This is the Lilly Ledbetter case. We actually give some very concrete tips about how to find out whether you're being paid less. One of them is to talk to recruiters. That will be a heads up. The other is that there's often a fellow in your office who has a similar job who would feel comfortable sharing what he is making. There are some employers who have rules against sharing salaries. Those rules are illegal in some states, but that's a very concrete way to do it. You can also artfully ask questions. For example, one of the wise women that we interviewed was a law firm rainmaker, and what she asked is there anybody in the firm with a book of business, a list of clients as large as mine, who's paid in this range of salaries? And the answer was no, and she got a raise.
I've always heard that sisterhood is beautiful, but why does gender discrimination sometimes breed conflict between women in the workplace?
Well, each of the three other forms of bias often fuel conflict among women. One of the most obvious examples is what I call the Marissa Meyer. Marissa Meyer famously said, "I'm not a girl at Google, I'm a geek at Google." She thereby identified herself with the in-group in a politically savvy way. And the studies show that women who have met with discrimination early in their careers often distance themselves from other women. And that's a classic tug-of-war pattern that undermines the aspirational sisterhood that we all like to believe
in. It used to be called the queen bee syndrome.
It used to be called the queen bee, but, you know, that framing intimates that it's a problem of some witch with a personality problem. And what I'm pointing out is if you have those kinds of relationships among women, it is a symptom of gender bias in the environment.
My guest is Joan C. Williams, who with Rachel Dempsey has written What Works for Women at Work, Four Patterns Working Women Need to Know. It's published by NYU Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, along these lines, a listener left this comment on our show page. She says, and I think it's a woman who has written in, "I had a female boss, a PhD just a bit older than I, who was known to be vicious in the workplace. At first, she gave me top reviews. Gradually, she got pickier and nastier, eventually becoming my nightmare. Instead of being a mentor to me, she effectively cut me off from becoming as effective as I could be and rising higher in the organization. I wonder if she saw me as competition."
Well, that's another classic reason for this tug of war bias. If women sense that there's room for only one or a few women at the top, of course, they end up undercutting each other. That's not called being a witch. That's called being politically savvy in a context of gender bias.
Another listener, Christine from Brooklyn, writes, "I experience these kinds of biases all the time in the New York City tech community. Are industries more difficult for women? Are certain industries more difficult for women than others?"
Absolutely. And it's important to have this conversation in New York City because I've talked to a lot of women in a lot of different industries, and by and large, tech and finance are more similar to what was going on in the 1980s in many other businesses.
Finance is harder for a woman.
Finance is harder. Woman is tech. Tech is harder. The patterns of gender bias are more blatant.
Is it because we think of them as male industries?
It's because that, you know, you think about the brilliant tech worker, you do not think of a woman. You think of a guy.
Although a couple of CEOs of tech industries have been women.
One of the important things about this book is it points out that the rules that apply to superstars are often very different than the rules that apply to women just one notch below.
So how does a woman become a superstar?
Often she has a very powerful male sponsor, including probably the most famous woman in the country right now.
You mean?
Sheryl Sandberg.
Oh, yes. Well, we could talk about her.
She's extremely brilliant. She's extremely politically savvy, and she had a male sponsor.
In her best-selling book, Lean In, she warns women against pulling back at work once they know that they want to have children, which could start years before they actually have them.
I think she gives very good advice, and that's in response to what we call maternal wall bias, the gender bias against women, against women once they have children, against mothers. Sometimes younger women pull back from stretch assignments because they think, oh, God, I could never do that after I have children. Sheryl Sandberg gives absolutely the best advice, which is the best way to prepare yourself for motherhood is to get as far as you can and command as much respect as you can before you have children. Now, should women have to do this? No, but it's a very savvy strategy to follow.
Haven't women often had to deal with being asked if they plan to have children, or being told that the company was reluctant to hire a woman of childbearing age because of that?
Well, that is, of course, illegal, but unfortunately, it's not uncommon. Also not uncommon is women being told to their face that they are being paid less than their male colleagues because the male colleagues have families to support. It's similarly illegal.
Amy in Manhattan asks, how do these biases affect women who work as freelancers?
You know, I was just talking to somebody this morning. This is one of the reasons why a lot of women work as freelancers. They leave organizations either because of motherhood or because they're fed up with putting up with these biases within organizations. So the biases can affect women, though, as freelancers in all of the same ways. Certainly, if a freelancer bargains hard, she faces that. She risks that witch problem.
And she may very well be offered less money to do the same job.
She may well be offered less money because she's seen as more of a risk. Women are often seen more of a risk.
In 2012, Anne-Marie Slaughter, who wrote the foreword for your book, wrote a story for The Atlantic called Why Women Still Can't Have It All, in which she argued that the structure of the workplace made it difficult for women to be happy at home and succeed at work. What are some specific biases that mothers face in the workplace?
Well, we often think of work-family conflict as proof that women can't have it all. And Anne-Marie Slaughter points out there are structural reasons why it's very difficult for mothers to flourish in the workplace. But what my book points out is that the gender discrimination against mothers is really dramatic. Actually, it's an order of magnitude larger than glass ceiling bias. And so a lot of the reason that mothers don't flourish in workplaces stems not from their internalized work-family conflict, but from very clear messages at work that they no longer qualify because they're mothers.
Why might women who don't have children run up against a maternal wall?
Women who don't have children run up against the maternal wall in several different ways. First of all, many times there's an assumption that even if you don't have children now, you're just about to pop one, and therefore you're not committed to the work.
So you have to bring a doctor's note and say,
yeah, exactly.
A menopausal is not likely.
Also,
And then you're too old for the job.
Exactly, exactly. Also, women end up in conflict with each other often over issues related to motherhood.
Have you looked at the situation of Janet Yellen? Did she have to overcome all of these things?
Well, you know, in economics, again, that's one of those workplaces that where the kinds of things that women meet is more reminiscent of what, so for example, women lawyers met in the 1980s.
Although now we have three women on the Supreme Court.
Again, superstars are different.
You write that one of the biggest mistakes women could make is to stay too long at a job that's not working out for them. Everyone goes through a rough patch at some point in their jobs, but what are some signs that it might be smarter for women to leave a job than to stay?
Well, we actually have two chapters on that. It's a very important subject for women. For example, if you're passed over once for a promotion, we tell you exactly what to do. It's not to leave in a huff. It's to go and to say, gee, I thought I was in the running for that. What do I need to do in order to be in a strong position? If you're passed over twice, then you really begin to ask. If you're passed over three times, then it's probably time to leave.
A listener, Brenda in Inwood, wrote, I'm a lesbian who has found that once men learn of my sexual orientation, they do a kind of recalculation of the dynamic between us. Some are uncomfortable at first, but then they're more ready to admit me to the men's insider club. That is, they decide to regard me as one of the boys.
You know, that's actually one of the things I'm looking for money to study now. And I think it depends on whether you're a lipstick lesbian who's a mother or whether you're a lesbian who's a little butchier, who's not a mother. But I think the dynamics are different in important ways for lesbians.
And we're going to leave it at there at that, unfortunately, because we've run out of time. But it's been fascinating. My guest, Joan C. Williams, distinguished professor and director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California, Hastings College of Law, author of a number of books, which brought her to the show in the past. This latest one written with her daughter, Rachel Dempsey, called What Works for Women at Work, Four Patterns Working Women Need to Know. It's published by NYU Press. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Always a pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.